Good morning and welcome to our podcast. My name is David Pritchard and I'm the head of marketing here at Sentence. I'm joined again today by my colleague Jonathan Tutu, who is a solicitor in the corporate team here at Sentence. And our podcast today, which will last approximately 20 minutes, is the second in our Understanding Corporate Law podcast series. And today, Jonathan is going to focus on terminology of asset sales, and this podcast is part one of two. So without any further ado, straight over to Jonathan. Jonathan, good morning and over to you.
Hi, thanks, David. And as David has said, I will just be going over some of kind of the key terminology of asset sales, including a few definitions and the general setup of what is included within an asset sale. The first part I'm going to discuss is the actual parties to the asset sale and who are to be included in it. The first one is quite key is the business. It is this exact business which is being bought or sold, and there will most usually be a description of the business within the agreement. There will be a buyer or purchaser, sometimes as they're known, which will be the entity or person buying the business. There will be the seller or vendor, which is the entity or person selling the business. Most usually, this is the company that runs a business, although if there isn't a company and the business is run by a sole trader or a partnership, it will be that partnership or the sole trader. As I go on to discuss the further terminology of the asset sales, I will be referring to them as just seller and buyer, but if they are multiple sellers, that will just apply in those cases. Rarely used is the term target, which is most often used when it comes to share sales, but sometimes lawyers do refer to the company being purchased, being the seller, as a target. The parties is all parties specific to that particular document or agreement, and that is usually the buyer and the seller. The company, as I've suggested, is a registered company, which is limited by shares, which is the most common company, or they can be limited by guarantee as well. A partnership, which I alluded to previously, is a partnership between two or more people running a business which isn't under a company. This is usually governed by a partnership agreement between the partners, and there is no kind of formal registry for these to be registered at. If somebody runs a company wholly by themselves and as an individual, they will be running it as a sole trader. Third parties. A third party is a party who is not party to the agreement itself. This is most often in relation to an entity which a business contracts with, or it might be a lender or a landlord. Finally, there is often guarantors in an agreement. A guarantor is a party who is standing behind, in effect, guaranteeing the performance of any of the obligations of a party in the agreement. They are often included to ensure payment of future consideration after completion has occurred, where there are things like price adjustment mechanisms or there is any form of deferred consideration in place. It is often either an individual seller, perhaps a seller that was part of the company before the transaction, or a top group company if there is a group structure in place. Next, I will move on to the different stages of a transaction. So first, I will define what a transaction is, which is sale and purchase of a business and the parts associated with it. The first stage of a transaction can often be a set of heads of terms, also known as a term sheet or a letter of intent. This is a non-binding document agreed between the seller and the buyer at the outset, although there is not always one in place for every transaction. It outlines the main issues relevant to the sale or purchase, provides some form of clarity of the initial terms of the transaction, although the parties are not bound to these depending on any kind of future negotiations or due diligence. And it often provides a period of exclusivity to prevent the seller, or at least financially dissuade them, from offering the company or the business or engaging in any further discussions with other potential buyers. Moving on to due diligence, this is an exercise undertaken for the buyer to ascertain information and documentation of the business to provide them with enough knowledge as is needed or perhaps required to formally commit to the transaction and enter into the agreement. This most usually comes in a set of queries and replies and further sets of queries and replies with supporting information and documentation. These are sent through by the buyers and returned by the sellers or their representatives. Due diligence is often broken down into several sections. There will be one for legal, one for tax, one financial, and one for commercial, if all are applicable. And these can be done by professionals, or they can be done directly between the parties, depending on the buyer's prior knowledge of the business, the purchase price, and the lender requirements, if there are any lenders sitting behind the buyer. due diligence is required, as there is always a warning of buyer beware or caveat emptor, meaning that the buyer should undertake sufficient due diligence of the proposed business they are purchasing before entering into any robust agreements for it. The agreement itself is often known as an APA or a BPA, which means an asset purchase agreement or a business purchase agreement, and that document is the key document of the transaction, setting out all important terms and referencing any other documents that need to be entered into. It will be signed by the seller, the buyer, as well as perhaps any guarantors. Disclosure is another process which will be part of the transaction, and it is a process whereby the seller informs the buyer about the current and historic contents, assets, governance, and arrangements of the business. I will now be moving on to speaking about pricing terms in the agreement itself. First one is the purchase price, and that will be the total amount payable for the business and assets by the buyer to the sellers in certain denominations. The second one is the completion payment, and this will be the amount payable to the seller on completion, and it will be the aggregate of the amounts set out against the asset in the agreement. This can be different to the amount of the purchase price due to various accounting reasons. For example, can be lower due to any kind of deferred consideration, which is to be paid to the sellers at a later date, or if there's any kind of repayment of existing directors' loans. Speaking about deferred consideration, this is often something requested by purchasers. It is an agreed amount of the purchase price, which is to be held back at completion by the buyer for a certain period of time. This allows the buyer to set off any claims that they have against this deferred consideration, and therefore not have to go through the process of a warranty claim if any kind of monies are going to be claimed back from the seller. The deferred consideration will have to be specifically drafted with conditions and timings bespoke to each deal. Following the deferred consideration, there is occasionally an earnout included within the agreement. This is where a seller, or perhaps a senior figure of the seller, has agreed to stay on in the business for a period of time post-completion, subject to being paid a certain amount on achieving financial or commercial targets. This is normally tied to the performance of the business by profit or revenue post-completion, and it provides the buyer with comfort that the seller will actively engage in the smooth transition of the business, and most importantly, in any relations they have with the suppliers or customers prior to completion, and ensure that there is a smooth transition of the business moving forward to the purchaser. I will now move on to the documentation included in an asset purchase agreement. I've already previously mentioned the agreement, or the APA or BPA. There is often schedules to these agreements, which is a section of the agreement relating to certain matters, which follows the main body of the agreement. It splits up the contents of this agreement in a digestible fashion, and also allows for changes to be made to that section without having to also change the main body. There will usually be several in an asset purchase agreement, and they will cover things like warranties, apportionments, property matters. There will also be a disclosure letter. This is a letter from the seller to the buyer dated on completion, and there is sometimes also one on exchange if it is going to be a split exchange and completion, containing statements and evidence of anything that contradicts the warranties. We will discuss the disclosure process and the importance of warranties and indemnities in a future podcast in the series. There will be some ancillaries or ancillary documents, which are other supporting documentation that are to be entered into to fully complete the transaction. These can often be things like board minutes and property documents. The term agreed form is often used in an agreement, and these cover documents, most usually ancillaries, which are previously agreed between the parties. There may be some third-party consents required in an agreement or for a transfer of some assets, and these constitute a consent, license, approval, authorization, or waiver required from that third party to the conveyance, transfer, assignment, or novation from a seller to a buyer. For that specific asset, an assignment is the process of the seller transferring its rights and benefits under a contract or arrangement to a buyer, and a novation is a contract between a third party, a seller, and a buyer that extinguishes the original agreement between the seller and the third party, with a new one being put in place between the buyer and the third party. Occasionally, there is a deed of release required, which is a document that confirms the formal release from another document by the business or company. This can often relate to any kind of security and will be entered entered into by a lender and the business. Sometimes a deed of surrender, which is quite similar to a deed of release, but is used for releases around leases and property matters, where there is to be no transfer of that property and the buyer is going to arrange a new lease with the landlord from completion. In terms of employment matters, there's often a settlement agreement between the business and an employee, whether that be one of the sellers or one of the employees of the business, to end their employment and waive any claims that they could have against the business for an agreed settlement fee. There is the ability to include a restrictive covenant, which is colloquially known as a non-compete agreement. However, this is most usually included within the agreement itself, and this stops the seller or certain representatives of the seller from competing with the buyer's business post-completion. They can include straight non-compete terms, non-poaching of employees terms, non-poaching of customer and suppliers, and they only apply for a certain time period after completion, which is normally somewhere between 2 or 3 years. And I will move on to a hive out, which is where certain assets of a business are transferred to a new company also owned by that seller, that business, and it is most usually done immediately prior to a share sale of the new company, so certain assets can be neatly packaged up and sold on. This also allows the original business to maintain certain assets and trading in different areas than the business that is to be sold. There's also a hive up, and this is just a shortened term for an intra-group transfer of assets from a subsidiary up to its parent company. Finally, I will note assets, as these are obviously the key components which are going to be transferred within the agreement. And the assets are the actual assets of the business that are to be sold or purchased. And the agreement should have a list of these in full for clarity. Excluded assets should be also included within the agreement, and this will be a list of the specific assets that are to be excluded in the agreement for clarity, to ensure that both parties know that these are not to transfer upon completion.
In the next podcast, I will discuss further particulars of an asset sale, particularly noting specific assets that are to be sold and purchased. Thanks, and back to you, David.
Thanks, Jonathan. Very informative. Looking forward to part two of this podcast. Very quickly for me, we release our webinars, podcasts, and blogs on a regular basis, all of which can be found on our website, www.sintons.co.uk, should you wish to take a look. You can also follow the corporate team at Sintons on Twitter, at Sintons Coco, which is at Sintons COCO. If you'd like to discuss anything Jonathan's raised today further in this podcast, or indeed in episode one, please don't hesitate to get in touch with us. Jonathan can be contacted via telephone 0191-226-7878 or via email jonathan.tutu@sintons.co.uk. Episode 3 and part 2 of the podcast you've just been listening to will be with you in approximately 2 weeks' time. Thanks very much for listening. Stay safe, everyone. Thanks for engaging, and we look forward to speaking to you next time.